Welcome to The Way of Product Design. I'm your host, Caden Damiano. This podcast has one mission: help product designers generate massive value for their clients, their companies, and themselves so they can do the work they enjoy the most. We know design is valuable, but how can you unlock the true value of design in your work? To help with this, I interview top performers in design, product management, and engineering so you can understand what's valuable to your stakeholders, your bosses, and your customers. So enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. Today's guest has a super long rap sheet. He's been around the block several times, it looks, and is just brings a wealth of experience to this show. I'm super excited. He's been at brands like 7-Eleven, Citi, and is currently just bringing his expertise to a bunch of different industries, fintech most recently. And I just super stoked for what we are going to talk about today. Today's guest is Michael Tinglin. Thanks for being on the show, man. Glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, before I was introduced to you, I saw a lot of your posts. You're an avid resharer.
Oh, I am an
of articles.
I think I'm known for it. There's a little method to that madness too. A little secret I'll let a few people know. I have a background in marketing as well, so I like to test algorithms on social platforms. And so I will post in a stream and do 20 back to back, or I'll do some with hashtags, some without, some with certain hashtags, some without. I'm always prodding and poking at the algorithms.
Oh, yeah, maybe some other time I could pick your brain on what you've learned. But yeah, I found a lot of interesting articles just following you on LinkedIn. And then this show, it's really just based on referrals on like who I interview so that I don't like keep my biases when, you know, sourcing guests. And when you were recommended, I'm like, hey, the reposting guy. Yeah. Sweet. I get to do a profile on the guy that has like a really good like repost game on LinkedIn. Michael, can you briefly introduce yourself to the listener? Just tell us a little bit about who you are, where you come from, and you know, and what you're doing today and why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. So my background in design started in the mid-90s, right around the time the internet was really taking off. I actually, though, started as a print designer. And so I learned a lot of the fundamentals of design and the psychology of design aesthetics through the print world. And then, like many people that got on board with designing for the internet early on, we were all frustrated that we couldn't do any of the things that we did in print. And it was pretty boring, needless to say. But over time, we developed some techniques to really stretch. And by the early 2000s, I found myself working. I had worked for myself for several years, but by early 2000s, I found myself working in the corporate world at Neiman Marcus. I helped to start their online division back in 2000. I was one of the first designers hired by them. And that really challenged me to up the design game online, because it was really tough working for such a major fashion brand and trying to communicate that level of brand messaging with the tools we had at hand and the techniques. So we were, just to let you know, this is way before CSS, we were slicing in tables, and yeah, it was very challenging, but still did some really good design. After that, I worked in travel for several years, and I did B2B. The focus was, as I grew in UX, I'd stayed at Neiman's for over a decade, so I felt like I did all I could do in fashion at that point. And I was like, I really want to try something that's not customer focused per se. There are pluses and minuses to each, obviously, as a designer, but B2B fascinated me to get involved in some enterprise systems and larger software systems. So got into travel and did B2B for some years. Then pivoted from that into marketing. Always was interested in marketing, especially from the fashion background aspect. But this was a little bit different. This was an executive role. And this agency that was outside of Austin was really big on UX and providing really good UX and UX capabilities as a service to the clients. And so that's what really attracted me to them as an organization. Stayed with them for several years, end up leading the marketing side of that agency over some time. And then after that, I decided I need to pivot again and focus more maybe on another sector I hadn't tried before. So I had, when I got out of retail the first time, what I did was I was like, I want to try travel. And I want to try fintech or finance and maybe health. And I was like, I think UX could go to all these different fields and really provide value. But in the earliest parts of UX as a discipline or even web design or design, digital design taking off, it was primarily retail. They were the biggest needs for it. And there were some software companies, obviously, like the Googles or whatever the world, but there were no social companies or anything like that at first. So anyway, got into finance for some time. And then after finance, it did another pivot back to retail, where I was at 7-Eleven for a while and led their in-store team there. And then currently now I'm back in finance again. So it's interesting also too how the UX is, because some of them you'll do in travel. I had the opportunity when I went to do B2B systems, I did B2B, B2C. I did some B2C work and I did B2B2C, which I thought was interesting too. Did that for a while. And so it just depends on this kind of mix that you get in different industries, what they need at what different time.
Can you tell me a little bit about, and this is just out of pure curiosity, like what kind of projects you were working on for 7-Eleven? Does that include like store layout or like stuff like
that? No, but I did. So we had a special team for that. The store, store evolution team. They deal with like architecture and how the store is and things of that nature, wayfinding and all of that. No, what we did is we tried to bridge the world between digital and physical. This is something I'm trying to get to catch on, so I'll keep saying it, digital.
Digital? Oh, okay. Digital.
But the reality was we would have to work with our in-store systems and really think about how the user was leveraging the digital products we would be making for them in the physical environment. And that was a little bit different in Neiman's, where I was strictly focused online and the website in particular, not really for store design or anything in the store. Here, it was everything from kiosks to customer facing displays to advertisement in the store to mobile checkout to points and rewards. So it was very interesting in there because they bridged that world of digital and physical.
So your job was to blur the lines.
Yeah, in a way, I wouldn't even say blurred lines, more so than saying make the experiences as seamless as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitively, as best as you can. There are going to be some certain limitations.
Yeah. And that's how I'm seeing, like when I'm reading this book right now called How Innovation Works. And it's basically, he redefines innovation as innovate. There's a difference between invention and innovation. Invention is just making something. Doesn't mean it's viable. Like Nokia invented tablets and like prototypes of smartphones before Apple, but they didn't make it into a viable technology for business. Like
they couldn't innovation scale it or didn't scale it.
Yeah. Or they didn't put enough resources into making it cheaper, more reliable, more accessible, more affordable. And that's what innovating is, focusing on like, how do we make this something that the common person could access. And then you look at generations of innovation, travel, like railroads used to be the big tech companies in the 1800s, and bridges and infrastructure. And then, exactly. And Rockefeller made oil cheap and accessible to the common person so that they could get cars. And now we got this new career called digital product design, UX design. And we used to think, oh, we're product designers. Like we're a big deal. It's no, we're like the next iteration.
Yeah, I would say that. And I think too, with the title changes, it confuses some people, like a UX design versus product design. In some places, it's not that different. At some places, it is different. And I think the difference is, depending on the org and the org structure, a product designer is expected to know a little bit more about the business than an average designer. And every designer should know about return on investment for the business and providing good outcomes for the business and hitting those business goals. But a product designer will probably think a little bit more strategic about how we do this, how we lay this out, when we do it this way, what's the ramification of it? Is this a phase two? Is this another release in the future? And work, I think, as a closer partner with product managers than traditional designers would.
Yeah, and you know what? And I feel like the iterations on purpose, right? Because I think the early iterations of UX design was okay, how do we do digital interfaces and whatnot? And now you're pointing out, like with your work, that it's like making the connection between digital interface and physical output almost. Is like as seamless as possible. It's like we're digitizing traditional business models.
Yes, and a little bit of vice versa. So you
Yeah.
want the physical things that people interact with to be as seamless and or easy to use as their smartphone is.
Yeah.
If you look at a lot of those physical systems or POS point of sale systems in particular, outside of Square, who's done a fantastic job with smaller businesses and creating a really easy to use POS, a lot of the POS systems are not easy to use. They're kind of tough.
Yeah.
And so even when you have a CFD or a customer facing display or a pin pad or something like that, we're used to that now, but it causes all kinds of weird consternation. Like I can tell you what's interesting to me, like tap to pay never really took off in the US. And people are like, oh, my car can tap and pay now. Actually, that we started that like 10 years ago. And several of us might have had cards and didn't even know they were tap to pay cards. Just never really caught on here. Just like QR codes are making a comeback, they never really caught on here. But like in Asia Pacific region, QR codes and tap to pay are like standard. You know what I
Yeah,
mean?
like
So,
WeChat, right? That's
oh yeah,
like basically
automatic.
how you,
It's QR code for everything, and even street vendors. But tap to pay is huge because you don't have to do your code and any of that, and there's a limitation on those transactions, so you feel a little bit safer. They're usually $45 and below. That's like a US translation of that. But yeah, so it's just funny when you see these things and you wonder why didn't it take off? Is it a cultural thing here, or is it the systems that the people are interacting with here and they feel like that's more pain than it's worth?
Yeah, you can't just put like a digital interface on top of an old, like unusable piece of hardware. You gotta rethink like how the hardware works. It's almost like a Tesla's becoming the new Apple when it comes to examples
Yeah,
of
I would
things,
agree.
right? Yeah, like they design the hardware. All the physical controls are very minimal on the Tesla. They've put basically all the controls of the car on a digital interface so that they could update it with software. And it makes it a timeless piece of equipment that ages well. And that's what designers need to focus on now is okay, how could we use like digital technology to make our hardware more efficient and vice versa, like you said. And you've probably seen it all. You've probably seen the ad, but you probably took part in like defining what UX in product design is. You've probably helped invent the role over your time.
Yeah, I would say I'll give you an example. Early on when I was at Neiman's, there were no real baselines in the early part, like in 2000. So like a shopping cart, everybody had a different one. People were using Flash for shopping carts. It was all over the map. And then over time, I'm going to be honest with you, how a lot of conventions come about is designers ripping each other off, truth be told. So if someone gets something and then their company gets, or they create a process, they create a design and a system, and then they're perceived to be successful, then other people are going to copy. And this happened like over and over and over again at Neiman's. It was ridiculous. Like we could always just watch a competitor and be like, wait next month. And then we could just go through and see them updating to catch us or something. What I would do though, in creating those conventions in the early part, before things started to become more conventional and we had more established patterns for how users did things. And some of that came through research. In the beginning, we didn't even have research. We just went off of psychology and ergonomics. Some of us who went to school and probably took ergonomics or heuristics, that's what we went off of. And a lot of us who had done web work early on knew, understood information architecture and just used logic. But I'll say that early on, it was like a Wild West. Everybody was trying everything. I remember when Amazon, to me, when they really got innovative was when they came with the one click, right? And when they instituted one click, we were like, yeah, we want one click as well. And then I think they had that patented. And we were wondering at the time, like there was a big debate, can you patent a process? All of these things that were still in the nascent part of the internet. But yeah, to your point, a lot of these conventions happen over time, and how they happen is usually people copying each other. Now, what I try to do is, if I'm in a certain industry, I'll look outside of that industry for ideas oftentimes. I'm not in the habit of just copying for the sake of copying. Now, we know that nothing's new under the sun and you do copy things, but culturally, I come from a background, especially involving in, being involved in music, where uniqueness is you should try to be as unique as you can be. And so it's always, what are you bringing to the table? How did you do it different? If something else inspired you, how did you improve it to achieve the goal that you're trying to design for?
Yeah, it's being original. And original and novel doesn't necessarily mean you completely invented the idea. Yeah. It's you synthesized your own spin on it based off your perspectives, what you know. And sometimes, and that's actually like what frustrates me. And before we get into our main topic, that's what frustrates me about, I guess, in design right now is, oh, we need to use this pattern because, you know,
Nielsen or McGraw, like
or yeah, or it's best practices, or Facebook does it. Oh my gosh, yeah, you just nailed it on the head. Yeah, oh man, like if Facebook does it, they have all these resources to really validate it, and we make that assumption that they've done a lot of work to validate it, and then we take that pattern and it doesn't work for us because it
wasn't designed, you know, for that.
Yeah, it's just the analogy of a tailored suit. If you just buy a suit off the rack, it doesn't fit. Like you just buy a Facebook suit, it's a little tight, you know, around the arms and stuff. Like when you have a tailored suit, it fits because it fits the situation. And I'm seeing like designers, like we're tailors, like obviously.
So you're gonna face a challenge. I think most designers would, and if they're like me, they have all the fonts in the world and don't use them. All of the systems, the design systems and the UI systems and components and don't use them. We'll do it from scratch all again. I think a lot of that stuff for me is just idea generation. It's just thinking. I probably will end up doing it from scratch anyway. But no, I think that one thing to consider about these patterns, and we're talking about these big companies and they're establishing patterns, is that though we have to take into account that some of the companies have so much weight and have so many users that they're technically programming the users to do it that way.
Mm.
So we have to look and say, okay, this person, Facebook or Google or whomever, they have 10, 20 million people using this software a day or an hour or whatever. Well, they're programming people to do it that way. So that's, I think, what leads a lot of us to look at them is just to your point, is it adapted properly? Does it really solve the problem that you're trying to do? Don't just copy for copy's sake.
Yeah. And you could always, you could take the idea and be like, oh, I really like this pattern, but you have to make it original for whatever you're doing. Not for the sake of originality, but the fact that you need it to fit your business and its use case. But that being said, yeah, adapt it. Yeah. But I mean, on to what I really want to learn, because you've been in a ton of industries. You've been around so long. You've seen everything, I bet. And before our interview, we talked about like potential topics we could talk about. And I usually just ask, what are you passionate about right now? What's something that you could easily start ranting about?
Oh my God.
You mentioned that UX being adopted by so many diverse industries, even outside of like traditional tech companies, and the inherent pitfalls. Can you articulate like the pitfalls and like the things that concern you from the quick adoption of UX?
Yeah, I think one is that UX is magic. This is a craft. And this craft takes a lot of skill to do properly and to achieve the goals and create the great outcomes and the ROI that every company wants. So UX isn't magic, and there's a process to it. I see with a lot of new industries, or when I say new, I'm probably saying 2020, 2010 after the first 10 years of it was really establishment of that and everything, making it economically viable. But what I've seen in the past decade or so has been a lot of other industries picking it up, and they think that it's going to solve all their problems, UX and having UX practitioners, whether internally or even as consultants. But that's not necessarily the case, because UX is an umbrella of CX, of customer experience. And that's how people view your entire brand in any interaction, not just digital interactions and not just physical interaction. That's how you're perceived. And I think that there's probably a lack of thought and strategy from maybe sometimes top down, but and sometimes it's just within a group, but a strategy about how best UX can support CX and how best UX should permeate, and certain principles from UX should permeate the organization. Example. So design thinking is super popular. It's great. It's fantastic. It has, just like anything, it has its pluses and minuses depending on how it's conducted. But I don't think that you should do design thinking for every little thing. I don't. And I think that's become a big trend. And for good or for bad, some people go, oh, you're UX people, so we need to have a workshop every day on everything. So no, we don't. We do those things to come to points of alignment as a group, to make sure that we're all agreed on what we're solving for, and then to take away takeaways from that so that people can start executing on that. And we have some reference point for when people inevitably drift. We can say, hey, come back. This is what we all agreed to that we're doing. That's a real, to me, main reason to design think. And then in a setting with the team or personally, it's for you to figure out how to solve it, how to actually go about solving it, breaking the work down and properly creating a cadence so that it can be achieved in the amount of time that you have to achieve it. So I just think that some people believe, some of the orgs, that UX is going to solve everything. And that's not true. If you have a tough business model or not the best brand identity, UX can't just solve all of that. You have a lot going on. And then there's this concept, I think, too, about the three-legged stool. This is what I'm hearing the most lately. Three-legged stool. And it's funny to me that one of the key legs is not included. So the three-legged stool is supposed to be product management, development, and UX. This is like every company, this is what they're saying now. And I'm like, have you tried to sit on a three-legged stool? Like, you got to really position it just perfectly so you don't tip over. I like the four-legged stool approach. I like to have marketing in there. And the reason I like to have marketing is because that helps to sell it and fulfill on the fantastic outcome that you want. So I could build the best experience in the world. If I can't get qualified users, and when I say that, people that I think would be interested in it, not just whomever, not just a shotgun approach or trying to get people to use the app or system or whatever. If I can't get them to do that, and this is primarily B2C, if I can't get them to do that, then it doesn't mean anything. Then it's just me designing on my computer at the house. You know what I mean? So I think that there's a missing leg to that stool, which is, I think, the other three groups who have come into ascendancy lately should not forget marketing. A lot of UX people, a lot of us as designers, worked under marketing or in marketing groups for a chunk of the time UX was inside corps. And a lot of agencies are marketing agencies that have UX capabilities, truth be told. So I think that's a miss. I think the concept of UI is dominating the concept of UX for a lot of people in different industries. So they think that we really just come and make it pretty. And visual design and the UI chops are definitively very powerful and needed, because I've never heard anybody go, oh my gosh. I've had a few people, but for the most part, you never hear people go, oh my gosh, their code is so elegant. Or you never hear them go, oh my gosh, this process was, well, a few people, this process was so easy or whatever. That's what you want. But the reality of it is, I think people always go, oh, this looks great. I think that's because I started that layer and then they peel the onion back. And what I have to do oftentimes is I'm going into a new industry or an industry that's new to it, or their group isn't really developed, or they may not have a mature UX practice, is to let them know UX is really more about how it works. And then what we want to do is look at your current processes and flows, because most of them have them. And then we want to see, then how do we best humanize these things? How do we make sure that it's supporting the user, whether those are internal users for B2B system or other B2B partners, or B2C, how are you supporting them so that they will complete what you want? You want the payoff, you want the ROI, you want them to complete the task. There's ways you have to do that. And I'll tell you something real quick about that. So in e-com and in retail, you want to get them through the cart and have them buy everything in the cart. Like, that's the goal. I will tell you, in fintech, and so in doing that, I think retail UX is what's really established. Like, don't do too many clicks, or a lot of rules that are like rules of thumb for UX. However, in fintech, I found that you might want to introduce clicks. You may want to introduce friction for strategically, because these are very big decisions sometimes being made with people's money, and you need them to pause and think about it. Mm-hmm. That was interesting to me coming into fintech. I was like, oh, that's the opposite of what I've done for a chunk of my career in retail, which is I got to get you in here and I need you to convert. I need you to buy everything in this cart, preferably. Do not abandon the cart.
Yeah. And a lot of people's experience, especially if they come from a marketing background, it's e-commerce, and it's really easy to apply mental models from something that's complicated like e-commerce, which it's complicated. There's a lot to go into a good store, but it's not complex. Like, the variables are pretty controlled. If they want something, there's consistent patterns that lead to success. But when we apply things to fintech, for example, like I work in fintech, I work in a lot of the company I work for, Homie's like covering a bunch of different stuff like home buying and stuff, but really like into making it affordable. So there's like a fintech aspect of it.
Yes.
And there is no playbook for digitizing home ownership right now. No. We're all figuring it out. And
yes. And so that's what's interesting. That's a great segue, actually. So what's interesting about these newer industries is it seems that their need for UX coincides with disruption in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point I want to make. So I'll say, when I first started, I'll give you a perfect example. When I first started 7-Eleven, I spoke with some people when I was interviewing, and I said, hey, tell me who you're worried about. This is a question I ask people occasionally. I'm like, whom? And they rattled off a few people, and about maybe five people. And I would say two of them were really disruptive. And I was like, yeah, okay, this makes sense to me now. I get it. Because oftentimes you have to weigh the reasons an organization is trying to do something, achieve something, or have UX people to see if it's a good fit for you. So I saw that and I was like, okay, this is disruptive. And I started to look at this too. When I was at Citi in particular, they saw some disruptors entering into the banking industry. And it wasn't just other banks. I was like, okay, I totally get this. And this is the correct timing for this. This is the correct time to build a group out and to do these things. So I always think that when we see UX needs in a new industry, it is usually in response to disruption, which I think is good, great for us, great job, great having jobs. However, I think that's reactionary. And I really like orgs that are trying to think ahead of the game and who really are seriously trying to not just disrupt everybody in their industry, but be the best org they can be or be the best business they can be and really service their people and their customers in a best in class way. I look for that as well.
So it brings up the obvious question then, that like, when do you think it'd be better to just bring on a product manager instead of a UX designer? Like, when should your response not be, oh, let's hire a bunch of designers?
Oh, yeah. So I think you shouldn't hire a bunch of designers until you have some idea of what your vision and strategy is. Mm-hmm. My opinion. And the reason that is, and you don't have to have every single little thing baked out. That's not what I'm saying. You should have a North Star. You should have a vision. And then you should have an idea of how this strategy helps the business and helps you in your sector, in your space, right? And then a strategy about how you're going to go about fulfilling on this. When you have that in there, now you need the players that are going to help you turn this vision into a reality, some form of tangible reality, digital or physical or otherwise, or combination thereof, whatever. And I don't think, and I think the way you phrased your question, it was like, or a product person. I don't think those are not mutually exclusive. I would probably, depending on how the orgs are, of course, I would probably say you get those product people in pretty early on. Set that tone, and then you bring your creative people in on to help you manifest that.
Yeah, that's what I'm starting to learn about more. I talk about design thinking. You got like the first two stages, empathize, define. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to see that the product management role is starting to evolve into owning.
Oh yeah.
That part of design thinking, which is great, man. If having a good product manager, this is probably the first time in my career where I have a product manager that is, oh, this is where you should be going. Here's my rationale for doing it. And I'm like, cool. I'll just design.
Let me tell you, it is worth its weight in gold. What I will tell you is, and this is a funny thing that you brought that up, Caden, because we as designers are creeping over into the developer world. Mm-hmm. So it seems like everybody's like pushing each other this way. So product management is in the UX world. And some product managers always had IA chops and as well. I've known product managers from even early 2000s that were great information architects. So it just depends on what their background is. But yes, a lot of them are taking this, what we used to call discovery. They're taking that discovery role. They're doing generative research, the whole nine. That's great. I think that, although I like dedicated researchers, but in any event, yes, it serves purpose. Now, a lot of designers, those and architects, they're bigger into prototyping. And then from a visual design aspect, when you start prototyping and you're doing all these extra screens because you're trying to create every state, it makes you just want to code the thing. Just yeah. Like, make this real or as real as possible.
Or you're like, yeah, at a minimum, you're defining functionality of what, okay, this is how the backend should be architected to support this experience.
Yes.
Like, you're architecting, and then like now the engineers are like in pushed. No offense, engineers, but you look at like any company where it's the first iteration is very engineering led. It's like very functional, but it's like a garbage product and just works because they hired a bunch of salespeople to shove it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. That's honest. A lot of the systems that we all get to work on, a lot of them are not new. They're legacy systems that we are updating and bringing a more rational user-centric approach to how they are used and how they're leveraged within the org. And we're talking like enterprise systems now. And it's not to be like, oh, we're going to make it pretty. I think that's a big misnomer.
No.
It's going to look great. However, it's going to work 10 times better.
Yeah.
Like I can say when I was in travel, the first times I got to really work on B2B systems, I was updating systems that were green screen, like teletype. I don't even know if you know what that looks like. That's think of 1980s.
Yeah.
Think of a terminal. If you're on a Mac, think of your terminal, think of DOS.
Yeah.
And that's the systems people were using in travel like 6-7 years ago when I was working in there. And I was like, okay, this hasn't been updated since the 80s. So now this is a big deal to just put a GUI on it. Not to enhance a GUI or make it better, to put a GUI on it was a big deal and a challenge. And when I did that, because we were doing some work for agents that would book cruise. And cruises, oh my God, I had no idea how many parameters were involved in booking a cruise. So in any event, but I tried to say, okay, and a lot of times it was smaller agencies or agents, home-based agents. And then you have to look at your audience. You look at screen size. You try to get any data you can now from the current system, whatever you can get. They might have done some surveys. You'll find out that some of your people that you're designing for may be older. So it's avoid certain things. And when I started to create a GUI and had pictures of the ship and plans of the ship, and they could click on it and choose, they were like, they couldn't believe it. They were like, no way. And that's what I love. I love to get that vindication back from the user. This is stellar. I love this. This makes my life so much better. That's what I want to hear from anybody I'm designing for.
Yeah. And I think that's a lot easier when you have a good product person that has established a vision of, we found out through research that this feature set or this value prop is very valuable. Now design, go forth and figure out how to deliver this value in your designs. I love research. I love doing it. I love getting insights and stuff. Mm-hmm. But what I love is actually I do love really executing on a good idea.
Oh, and that gets me going at 2 a.m. So that's what gets me going and coming up with an idea at 2 a.m. is I like that. And as I said, I've been a leader, I've been an executive, and I like to design. And I will continue to design. I do not believe these things are mutually exclusive. I think people put themselves in boxes.
Or you can't go back to IC roles.
I have
after being a manager, which I'm looking at your LinkedIn right now, and I'm like, no, this guy's
Whatever's clever, Trevor. That's I think that it depends on where you're at in your life and what you want to do. I think that people have a very. It's funny. People that work in an agile environment are not agile with their lives. It's funny.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah,
dude, this is for me. This is a sprint, right? So this chunk I'm working at this company, that's a sprint as far as I'm concerned. That's a part of my life sprint. And I'm going to go in, I'm going to learn this, I'm going to contribute this. And when I exit, this is what I want to take with me to the next set of roles. And I think that people, there are pressures on us, especially as you get older in a creative industry or in anything tech in particular, you'll feel that you have to go up. I think it's great to experience that, but I also think that leadership is not for everyone. And I also think that you shouldn't feel like, oh my God, I have to do this or I can't get a job. No, don't think like that. People want people to help them. And in any way and capacity you can bring help to the table and provide good outcomes, they will want you. And that's what you should concentrate on, doing great work. As I said, though, I know people chase titles and they want different things. I'm just saying it's not all it's cracked up to be at any level.
Yeah, totally. And also, moving up doesn't mean that's the only way to make more money, right? Oh. It's because like a principal designer should be compensated like a VP of design.
Yes. And it depends on the org, but usually it's at least like a director level.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, actually, no, finish your thought. This is your episode. So
thank you. No, I was saying what I've seen is lately a lot of orgs are creating IC roles, more and more of these IC roles, where you get to move up and you don't have to necessarily manage people. And the reason I say that this is not cut out for everybody, because there have been organizations I've been a part of where you could tell there were managers who only got that role because of tenure, because of how long they've been there, seniority, but they're terrible people managers, or they're not good at this part, or you haven't coached them properly. And then that just causes all kinds of ripple effects throughout the org, negative ones. And then now people are working around them. It's like, why are we doing that? That's not necessary. And it takes a lot of emotional intelligence to be a leader and to motivate people. It takes a lot. Okay. There's a time and a place for everything. And so you have to know and be able to read the person, read the room, read the team, and understand what's the best way to motivate everybody to achieve this result and this goal. But you would be surprised how many design orgs in corporations don't have a good way to measure any success. So the issue that you face when you're not measuring anything is you can't use that as a motivating factor. You can't show people where they contributed. And then so they can build off of that. So they can learn off of that. So they can get better and they go, oh, I get it now. So I would always, anybody I would work with or lead as a team, I would try to get the designers to understand business and how business works and why you're there and the difference between design and fine art. And you would think that many people know this, but they don't. And it's, look, this is not, if I just want to be an artist, I'd be down in Deep Ellum on the sidewalk with a guitar and chalk drawings. I'd just be kicking it. But if I'm trying to create commercial ends and goals for the organization I'm with and myself, then I have to think a little bit differently about it. And that's why I like to put it more in a craft mode. I think people get craftsmen or craftswomen are creative people that sell their wares or sell what they create. And but I think that puts people more in a proper mindset of how they should think about UX and as a discipline is, hey, this is design. It is there to achieve certain endings, primarily economic endings, not always, as we see UX now taking off in the foundation world and in the social activist world. And so that's great. And that's transformative for society. But most of design and most of what we'll all be engaged in will be for an economic end.
Yeah, helps the economy, helps everybody, hurts nobody.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
that's why we get into it.
And also it's people put a damper on economic stuff, but I don't know why. But we like going to movies. We like eating out and you need money. You like going on vacations to Cabo. It's just those, you are the life experiences you have. And that's like a whole nother podcast on, hey, UX, it's a very high influence, high impact career. If depending on the companies you work at, still job.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. And something else to consider when we are creative people, I think the concept with the money part is like you're selling out, right? No, you can sell out, but that's not what design and you making a living off of design is about. And I think that comes just from creative people, because most creatives in society usually have a personal message too that they're trying to get through and get across through their work. And from a fine art perspective, or even I've known this, I've done this with my musician friends for years, we talked about, did someone sell out? I'm like, yeah, when you're young, you can say things like that. When you get older, you're like, no, I need to achieve this, do this, pay for this. I have responsibilities. So it's a different, little bit different game. Even the young and older musicians are the same too. So younger musicians, they're like, oh, they sold out. And then when they're older, they're like, oh, you didn't invite me to the award ceremony. I don't get to open for such and such. You're like, oh, okay, now you care. Before that was selling out. So I think it's just also to where you are in the life cycle of your career. But I would caution people, do not make your career linear. I have a firm belief that creative people aren't actually valued as much in society as we think they are. Because some creatives are valued and there may be celebrities. And so some people believe that all creatives are valued, but that's far from the truth. Very far from the truth. I think creatives in any society, especially in industrialized societies, aren't needed until they're needed. Or people don't think they need us until they need us.
We didn't need UX designers until the internet matured to a point where we could optimize those digital channels.
In its current form. But remember that early on, as people started to get personal computers, how people interacted with those systems and operating systems is UX as well.
That's true. The OG UX guys were just engineers.
Yes.
Yeah.
And more like ergonomics, like why a keyboard, why a mouse, why a GUI, why a graphic interface versus the terminal? Why do you put the trash can there? Like what their thinking went behind this. So we can say technically it started a little bit earlier, but with the boom, with the internet came a boon for this skill set that we are still in now.
Yeah. And you're totally right. I think design thinking is really old, but I think the professions that kind of was nested in and what problems were being solved changed with how advanced technology was. I'm going through the biography of Isambard Kingdom Brunel. He made the Thames Tunnel, Great Western Railway, but it was one of those titans of industry, engineers that with dredges and stuff, forcing into existence, fighting nature, building canals, that kind of stuff. But it was them just having the vision of, there's a story in the book where, he's riding one of the first railways and it's a really bumpy ride. And this is when that was the big new technology. Everyone's getting in the railway business, trying to get contracts to build railways and stuff. And he just wrote, he had this concept called a castle in the sky, which is a moonshot goal for them back then. But it was maybe one day I could actually write while riding on the train and it's a smooth experience, I'm flying or gliding.
Yeah.
And he made it happen.
Yeah.
Experience. He focused on the experience.
That's what I'm talking about. So it's how it is. How does it work? Yeah. How does it make somebody feel? There are psychological underpinnings to this. And as I said, I learned in fintech, you don't just give them everything as quick as possible because that can be dangerous. You might have to say, are you certain you'd like to transfer this $10,000? You know what I mean? You might need to throw some friction in there and
think. And adding that friction is basically you as the designer respecting the precedent from hundreds of years of lessons learned. I think that's respecting the laws of innovation, which is really just a small iterative tinkering process. And you can't have a smooth railway without a rough one. We need to have the rough technology, that the ugly baby first. And we got to respect that and know our history of the technology, the space to make good experience solutions, or at least know what problems to solve.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Think of this too. A lot of the social economy that we have now, and social networks that are so popular, these are not and we said this earlier, these are new manifestations of some things that were around from the beginning of the internet, or concepts. We had chat rooms, we had messaging, we had trying to create a space, a virtual space for you to do things with other people. These concepts were there. It's just over time, the technology to make those better and truly the interaction level could be on the real time, could be real time the way we wanted it to be. And then you saw it take off. You know what I mean? And they have their cycles too. Some industries, I think they're safer than they are. Social, I would say that.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, as I think governments around the world see the power of social media, yeah, this crackdown is coming and this regulation is coming. And that's with the US all the way to North Korea. Like, everyone sees the power of this medium. They're not just going to let it be unregulated. It's just not going to happen. I think the regulations that will affect it will be more on the lines of what affects traditional media.
And I think that the patterns that we use and products will change as regulations come down. Like, yeah. I'm kind of making this is a talking head prediction. I'm making the prediction that like free trials are going to be over. I think as we like make illegal the dark patterns that keep you and make you accidentally pay money for things, then there's going to be friction involved as a user. Like, you're going to have to pay. It's like journalism.
Yeah. Oh, journalism has gotten hit the worst.
Exactly.
Great point.
Like, now you can't get like a reputable news source without going through a paywall. And I think that's correct. Yeah, I think that's fair. It's like, if you want good.
I'm a 50-50 on that because
go ahead.
I remember when display advertisement was new and it was still pretty effective, the news sources could support themselves properly or their web properties that way. I think here's another thing too. I think that for all of the newness of the internet and the economy and this fan and the growth in it, for my generation, it's definitively the sector that has employed most of us. I don't know if it truly has made up, right, for what was lost. Why I say this? There's a tendency amongst tech entrepreneurs to say, oh yeah, this thing I'm inventing, it's going to put 10 million people out of work, but it's going to create 20 million new jobs. But no one talks about the quality of the new jobs. Because usually what they're doing, and when they're disrupting and displacing people, they're not the ones creating the new jobs. So my background's in social sciences, anthropology, and sociology. What I would ask is, okay, great. What's the quality of the new jobs? And we don't use that as a hindrance on innovation, but we need to take that into account because all of these things are for the service of the species. So no other species does, you know, like AI. I have some issues with AI. I love AI in concept. I've been a robot fanatic since I was a kid. However, I think we need to put some rules and regulations and parameters around AI and the use thereof. Like, why would we as a species put ourselves out of work? For what? To do what? To go where? To impress who? For why?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard a clear answer to this yet.
I think the businesses that there's going to have to be like new businesses and products now to fill that gap of the job to be done of having meaning. You could say that like DoorDash and a lot of these gig apps do that, like they're fulfilling that role. But it's definitely very immature on from an industry perspective on, what happens to the people that get displaced, right?
Like to me, there just should be better societal planning for this. And I think Elon has sounded the alarm at the same time he's made Neuralink, but he sounded the alarm that if we don't put some parameters around, this can really be detrimental to us.
For sure. We're coming up on time. I don't want to spend too much time. I want you to enjoy your afternoon, spend time with people you care about and stuff. But I really appreciate this. I think like the big takeaways for me, like the new wrinkles in my brain from this is when you validate like the value of design, you're also showing how valuable like product management is. And then also we're also forgetting about the people that used to be in the forefront of like product, which is the marketing guys.
Yeah. And BAs and traditional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's more of a 6-footed bench now. I think we're really like all the people that put together like a great offering and stuff, but not just because we have these new jobs and, you know, refined or focused on delivering value and good experiences, which is, you know, great for, you know, humanity, is where businesses are prioritizing experience more because like we're getting diminishing returns on like engineering improvements to products. You can't say it's faster now and then sell it.
No, I think you're correct. I think that experience has become a differentiator, but that's been a challenge for us as designers as well, because design is starting to get cookie cutter because we converge and diverge as a discipline. So we converge on new trends and everybody's like, glass morphism, skew morphism, right? And then that crashes or doesn't crash or whatever. We all get sick of it, like flat. I'm totally sick of flat. And then, and we've done flat four or five times, called it four or five different things. And then we diverge again. And if you have enough weight, then you can, people will start to come your way on the convergence. I think weight has a lot to do with it.
I think UI is getting to a place where it is very cookie cutter. But if like product designers or UX designers or whatever, like really want to differentiate themselves, now's the time that like, we don't have to spend as much time, especially if you have a good design system. We don't need to spend as much time pontificating on what they, Like now, like actually JB Chakowski said, I predict that most design when it comes to UI is going to be done by a central team. And then everyone else, all the other UX designers are going to just be moving around Legos, and all they're going to focus on is architecture, the kind of the systems thinking. Like those are now the new critical thinking and soft skills, and like facilitation skills are now like the new killer skills to have.
Yeah. So I'll tell you, in fintech is where, in retail, I've really got to flex my architecture muscles. I believe that most UX orgs are not putting a proper emphasis on a couple of different UX subdisciplines. One being architecture, the second being UX copywriting, the third being having a dedicated prototype or someone, or a UI developer, somebody that bridges the teams between design and dev. I think these are a big miss. If orgs aren't setting their pods up this way, or they're not looking for the skill set amongst their generalists, they're missing the boat, period. You can't just have your designers making up copy. That's a fail. And there's numerous examples of this. And an architect, the plus of that, of having an architect, is to really have somebody that can really suss out all the problems ahead of time and give some clear path, if it's even the happy path, some clear path of what the visual designer can concentrate on, what the UX designer can concentrate on. And I've been a strict architect only, and I've done that at all types of resolutions and fidelities, but I find that works really well. A dedicated architect, dedicated designer, dedicated copywriter. That's, to me, the best team setup. But I know, Really? Yeah, I think orgs gravitate towards generalists. Usually, my opinion is financial. I'm going to be honest. They're trying to cut headcount. But what we would do, even at Neiman's and working in retail, is we didn't even have it that defined. You just fell into a role. And if you were fantastic at it, then that was like your thing.
That's your job.
Yeah. And then what we would do is we would look for ancillary skills. So one of the best designers I ever worked with on a team, he had a background in video editing and motion graphics. And so bringing him to the table was fantastic for fashion. He helped up all our game, and I could edit some video too, but nowhere like him. And then we'd had other people who had a process background. They'd worked in print, in giant print shops, crazy deadlines. They were so good. So when we brought them into the UX world, they helped refine our processes. We just cranked up the productivity like by 100%. So you want to look for people that have these ancillary skills. But my opinion is, let people concentrate on parts of the process and do it well. And if you do that and you have a vision and a strategy, you usually get the best outcomes.
It makes you think that, because yeah, they're trying to reduce headcount because they want to have like that three-legged stool for a lot of like minute problems across the business, like squads dedicated to one problem space. Or you have multiple specialists focused on a broad problem space. And yeah, now, this is me pontificating. And actually people are like, oh, don't solution in meetings. I'm like, I'm not solutioning, I'm pontificating. Like, I'm just talking out loud, thinking out loud.
I would ask, why can't we solution in the meeting? Why are we having a meeting?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, well, we need to be able to just think out loud, and it's a form of synthesis. But yeah, it's like interesting because imagine if you could increase production, which have a dedicated prototyper, dedicated UI designer, dedicated UX architect that just focuses on, okay, I'm going to figure out every nook and cranny of this problem space. UI guy jumps on the problems, turns out like really great UIs. And then prototyper
that supports the thinking, that supports the architecture.
You have that team. And that's what I'm thinking, because I actually like am considering maybe pivoting, depending on the company, pivoting into product, but being more of an architect, product manager.
I'm with you 100%. I've told several UX people I know that we should get involved in product. We shouldn't just go downstream. Let's go upstream. And the reason I say that is because outside of many of us not having an MBA, we understand every other part about it, right? You're there, solve a problem, give the users what they want, make money. It's not rocket science, truth be told, in the overall grand scheme of things. So I feel that UX people have a lot that they could bring to product management if they can just deal with the business facets to it, because there's a lot. There's a lot of reporting. There's a lot of analytics.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that go with it. And it's not like it's all cherry and rosy, not by a long shot. It is not easy either. But I think there's a lot that UX people can bring to the table because of the way we think and how we have to think to solve problems.
And then also, I think like an MBA is like overkill for PM role, because you know, Elon Musk brought it up, right?
So
like MBAs are ruining companies because they're worried about business. What are you trained in when you get an MBA? It's business administration. You're looking at P&Ls, you're looking at financial predictions and models.
That's like, not necessarily entrepreneurship.
That's not product either.
Or innovation.
Yeah, or innovation, yeah.
That's true. And I was, before I became a social science major and did interdisciplinary studies, I was a business major. And so I know this truthfully. And I got out of it because I've always had an entrepreneurial bent. And I asked one of my profs, he asked everybody, why are you here? Why are you in a business administration program? And I was like, I want to own my business. I want to be an entrepreneur eventually. And he was like, can't teach you that. I can teach you how to run somebody else's business. I can teach you what to watch out for when you become an entrepreneur and you have people working for you, but can't teach you how to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah. There's like the vehicle. There's like the structure of the business that like you house the product in, but those are supporting roles. And we need that. We need that. But when it comes to product, I'm like the product management job, there's a lot of reporting and stuff like that. But
a lot of non-designers.
That's just what's keeping designers from going there. But at the same time, it's the most high leverage position. Designs get reiterated every couple of years.
Yes,
even
the best of designs get redone every couple of years.
Yeah, and so the design isn't very high leverage. It's high fun. It's because it's craft and you get in flow more. Yeah. But product, it's like when you're making decisions on architecture, re-architectures don't happen that often. Like when you put your thumbprint in a company, when you architect something and when you prioritize things, you mobilize millions of dollars of resources, depending on what company you go work for. That's if you can make just like a few good decisions in a year and prioritize a few good ideas, like that's super high impact.
Yeah, and you can really move the needle. To be honest, though, maybe a UX generalist would be better for product, though, because there's so much you have to have a deep knowledge of.
Yeah.
Generalists actually may do better that way, to be honest, because they're used to dealing with so many different things and seeing the similarities
between
that seem divergent to other people. So that's just something to think about. But I do think that UXers should start to look into product management roles, especially on a startup level. There shouldn't even be a barrier there.
Yeah. And that's what we're finding out. My CPO designer built the design team at Redfin and director of product designer. And it's just great I think UX, if you're a generalist, like if you're just, you're good at everything, but you're not... Because there are designers that just love getting into prototyping, that just love getting into the pixel perfect UIs and stuff. But yeah, like I could see why I'm drawn to product, because I'm not necessarily married to my work. If I could get another designer to see the vision and do it for me, I'm happy.
I like the process, and I tell everybody you have to like the process so you have the stamina to achieve these things, large goals over time. However, I like the outcomes. That's what drives me. And that's what makes me go through the process. I like the outcomes. And so if I can achieve that outcome in product, or if I can achieve that, which I've done, I have a background in product as well, but if I can achieve that in product, or if I can achieve that in design, or if I can achieve that in development, whatever I can contribute to that great outcome, that's what I want. And I think that in some of the disciplines that are new in incorporating UX into their workflow and into their corporate culture, they may not fully understand all that UX can contribute to those outcomes either. as I say, because of these stereotypes of UX. Oh, it's all design thinking, or hey, it's make it pretty, or I think
it's post-it notes.
Yeah, it's post-it notes. I hate stickies, by the way. I know several people are going to listen to this and be like, yes, we know Mike hates stickies. I hate stickies.
Yeah.
I see their validity. I see their validity and their use of it in design thinking. Yes, I get it. I get it. However, I've done plenty, made millions without them. So, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the first principles. But Michael, I really like this. I think the one thing that I really admire about you is that you're thinking like long game. You've been in this so long, because for a lot of ambitious young people like me, it's I got to become a manager as young as possible, because that shows I'm like have a steep career growth. But then what happens when I'm 40?
And what you want to do, if you're saying you want to be on executive track, then yeah, that might behoove you to try to pull that off earlier than later. But what I'm trying to let people understand is don't get caught up in a title and going, oh, if I was a manager now and I can't be a manager or director the next gig, my life is wrecked or ruined. I'm like, I don't know. Are you getting paid less? If not, then maybe you're doing okay.
Yeah, it's like, well, you could go achieve in life.
You
could be like a manager or something, and then like your next gig, you get paid more and you're just an IC. Listen, I don't see it. Why, that's not bad. That's not a bad gig.
I was an executive and got paid more as a UX architect contributor than I did as an exec. So then there's that. So
there
just depends on the parameters and what you're trying to achieve with your life. But for some people, they get divorced from the process. And that's the true thing. You might get divorced as you move up the totem pole from the IC process. And if so, if you don't keep your chops up, yeah, you might end up sucking as a designer after time. I like to design. So as I said, I like to keep designing and keep my chops fresh. And it also, I think, makes me empathetic when I have a team, because I know what it takes to achieve a thing, how long it'll be, and the pain and suffering I'm asking them to go through now to achieve this.
Now, the best,
I know firsthand.
Yeah, the best managers are good at it.
All the designers, when I first came up, even in print design, in the early digital, all of the leaders were designers. It was after in the mid 2000s, I started noticing people who had no design relation running design groups. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And just all kinds of people. And I was like, okay, so is this just, we're just handing out titles? How's this going here? Because this is really weird to me. So I like the craftsman thing. And I think that even if you look at the artists that we all extol, Da Vinci, right? Da Vinci was the master craftsman and he ran that shop. And he had plenty of other craftspeople. It's not like he carved every statue, painted. He couldn't do it all. He only had two hands, two eyes.
Yeah, product managed, man.
Right. He had a whole crew. He had a team. They probably had a guild or whatever. And they divvied up the work as they needed. And they had levels, sets, and degrees based on your proficiency. And they worked together. And the master craftsman led them.
Man, yeah, I love that. It's so true. It's like Thomas Edison had hundreds of employees. He was PMing. You look at Steve Jobs, he championed design. I'm like, but he was a PM. Like Johnny Ive was the designer.
Yes.
In a literal sense. It's when people ask Steve Jobs, hey, what do you do here? And he's like, oh, I make the decisions and I just tell them what I want.
And that's a big deal. And I'm telling you, there are a lot of people who flirt with leadership or management and they don't understand all the psychological stuff that goes with that. Depending on the org and where you're at and everything, it can be a little unending. There's no turning it off. It's not, if people always, you got to find balance. Yeah, whatever. It's not true. You don't turn it off. If you own the company, you're probably never going to turn it off. And that's just part and parcel of the process of dedicating yourself to achieving very large goals. Now it depends on what your goals are. For some people, there might be my goal isn't to go to Mars. Then that's not such a heavy lift. That's Elon wants to do that. That's a heavy lift. That's a crazy, literally it's heavy to get things into space to take them to Mars. So that's a huge goal. And that's going to be somewhat consuming of his life in order to achieve.
And his legacy probably. Mm-hmm. Michael, this has been an awesome conversation. Probably one of my favorite podcast episodes that I've recorded.
Great convo. I am very thankful that you invited me.
Do you have anything else you want to say before we sign off?
Oh, no. Yeah, no.
Respect. Yeah. I think you covered a lot, all the bases. Yeah. Hey, thanks for coming on the show and you have a good one. Thank you.
Thank you. And you take care and have a fantastic Memorial Day weekend.
And you too.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks again for listening to The Way of Product Design. One quick favor, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your network, your friends, and hit that subscribe button on the show wherever you're listening to it. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I'm really excited to bring more awesome interviews and content your way. So keep listening, you won't be disappointed.